I want to start by reading a passage in Psalm 73. This is a psalm of Asaph that's famous for being applied to the world around us and the world at all times. There's always been this dynamic going on in the world where people are doing wrong and seeming to get away with it. Psalm 73, verse 7, it says, "For I was envious at the foolish when I saw the prosperity of the wicked. For there are no bands in their death, but their strength is firm. They're not in trouble as other men, neither are they plagued like other men. Therefore pride compasseth them about as a chain, violence covereth them as a garment. Their eyes stand out with fatness. They have more than heart could wish." Have you ever had that thought in your heart? How is it that wickedness is so popular in the world and so successful? So many evils in our society are abounding, and all we need to do is open our eyes, and it seems like every day more and more people go over to that wicked side. Right now, it's obviously some of the overt, blatant wickedness involves homosexuality, abortion, the transgender movement, and so forth. Right now, we're in the middle of LGBT Pride Month, and it seems like every day there's a new organization, a new company that is siding with homosexuality and promoting all of this. Kellogg's cereal, they're going after the young children. I saw that Kellogg's cereal is coming out with cereal boxes that are going to promote pride, and on the backs of the cereals, the children are going to be able to write, you know, whatever name they want. They're going to be able to write, express however they feel, express their own gender identity. And there's this overt sinfulness going after the young generation as well as old. And it seems like every day more and more people switch over to the side of standing against God. So what do we think about this? Their numbers seem to increase more and more, but we need to know, according to Psalm 73, we're not going to go on in Psalm 73, but as you go on, it shows that their days are numbered. The days of the wicked are numbered until finally God will bring them down. We need to know that to stand with them, to switch over to their side, is ultimately to stand in a place of judgment by God. So don't be deceived into joining their sinister ranks. And as David, let's get to 2 Samuel chapter 17. David has been on the run from Absalom, and it seems like this is happening to him, that wickedness is mounting against him, and the numbers are far with Absalom. There's a small contingency of people that has fled Jerusalem with David, but most of Israel, most of Jerusalem is with Absalom in the rebellion, in this mutiny. So how is David going to survive this? And perhaps the numbers are too great and people should just join what seems to be an inevitable conclusion of Absalom. The only problem is that God was with David and was against Absalom. That's the theme that we're going to see in 2 Samuel 17. I've entitled the message today, Sovereignty versus Rebellion. We have the sovereignty of God on one side, and then we have the rebellion of man, of Absalom, but we could say of any man on the other side. And I want to divide, we're going to get through verses 1 through 23 today in this chapter, 2 Samuel 17. I want to divide it into four sections. And first of all, we see Ahithophel's advice. So remember, David has fled, and Ahithophel, one of David's former advisors, a wonderful counselor, has sided with Absalom. He's got a personal grudge because David has committed adultery with his granddaughter, Bathsheba, and then murdered her husband. And so Ahithophel is on Absalom's side. Now it comes. David's fled. They're getting ready to go after him. What should we do? And Ahithophel gives his advice. 2 Samuel, let's start with verse 23 of the last chapter, 2 Samuel 16, verse 23. And then we'll go straight into chapter 17. It says, "And the counsel of Ahithophel, which he counseled in those days, was as if a man had inquired at the oracle of God. So was all the counsel of Ahithophel, both with David and with Absalom. And then as the chapter turns the page, we see that bear out with his advice. Verse 1. Moreover, Ahithophel said unto Absalom, let me now choose out 12,000 men, and I will arise and pursue after David this night, and I will come upon him while he is weary and weak-handed, and will make him afraid, and all the people that are with him shall flee, and I will smite the king only, and I will bring back all the people unto thee. The man whom thou seekest is as if all returned, so all the people shall be in peace. And the saying pleased Absalom well, and all the elders of Israel. So we're told starting out that Ahithophel gives great advice, almost like if you would ask God himself, the oracle of God. On a human level, Ahithophel's advice here is smart. It would save the nation from a long, drawn-out civil war. The battle would not destroy Jerusalem. That, by the way, that's because of David. David has fled Jerusalem so that the capital city and so that God's people there in the city are not the casualties of this war. He goes out into the wilderness. And if David only is killed, this is Ahithophel's advice, we're going to go take 12,000 men and we're only going to kill David. That's it. Then we're going to come back. If David only is killed and everyone unites behind Absalom, then that's a best case scenario for Absalom's ascent to the throne here. And as soon as Ahithophel gives this advice, it is well received by everyone. It says by Absalom, by all his elders, great advice. But notice how unbiblical Ahithophel's advice is. So on one side, it is street smart. It's a good strategy. But on the other side, it is unbiblical because notice what Ahithophel says in verse 2. The phrase he literally says is, I will smite the king. I will smite the king. This is what David dared never do in his life when he had the same opportunity. When Saul was chasing after him and he could have killed Saul, he says, I will not do this thing. Far be it from me to do this thing, to stretch forth my hand against the Lord's anointed. Ahithophel doesn't care about that. Ahithophel says, I will smite the king. There were others that did this. There were others that didn't even do it, but claimed to do it. And David had them put to death. You don't rise up against the king. He's God's anointed. He's God's authority. So this is very unbiblical advice that Ahithophel gives. And it doesn't know, or it doesn't matter how many people are on the side of this. This is why it's ultimately going to be unsuccessful. And that's what we need to know at all times in life, that any unbiblical advice will ultimately come to naught. Listen to Proverbs 11:21. Though hand join in hand, the wicked shall not be unpunished, but the seed of the righteous shall be delivered. What does it mean for hand to join in hand? It means it doesn't matter how many people cooperate and work together and are unified and pool their resources and pool their expertise. It doesn't matter. The wicked shall not be unpunished. And if you've got an idea that is unbiblical, it is ultimately going to come to naught because any unbiblical idea is fighting against God. Notice also here in Ahithophel's advice how many times he references himself. Interesting. He does it at least five separate times in three verses. Let me just rehash it very quickly. Verse 1, he says, I will arise and pursue after David. I will come upon him while he is weary, and I will make him afraid. Verse 3, I will bring back all the people unto the end of verse 2. I will smite the king only. And so he says, I will do this. I will do this. I will do this. And it seems like, I don't know if Absalom kind of sees through this. This plan seems to be all about Ahithophel. He has taken this very personal. He obviously has a personal grudge, a personal bitterness. He says, Absalom, you stay here, give me 12,000 men, and I will go and do all of this myself. And I wonder if that is a crack in the door, if that opens the door to Absalom maybe looking beyond Ahithophel's advice. It's like, yeah, this is a great plan. This is really good advice. The only thing is, you seem to be kind of a psychopath here. You seem to be a little bit too personally invested. Maybe you ought to recuse yourself of this thing. Maybe there's a conflict of interest going on here. And so maybe his judgment, maybe Absalom's thinking his judgment may be a little clouded by his personal dog in the fight, his personal bitterness here. So that's Ahithophel's advice. Let's take 12,000 men. We'll go after David only. We'll kill him. We'll come back. That'll be the end. And Absalom says, great advice. And then all of a sudden, something gets in his mind somehow. And he says, by the way, I wonder if we have any, that was wonderful advice. Best advice I've ever heard. I wonder if we have any better advice. So look what he says in verse 5. Number 2, we get to Hushai's advice. First Ahithophel, and now Hushai's advice. Remember, Hushai was the man that was going to flee with David. And David says, no, why don't you go back? And why don't you try to overcome the advice of Ahithophel? Try to give some advice that will overturn his good advice, because I know it's going to be good advice. So you go and try to stick a monkey wrench in the works. So let's read about it, verse 5. Then said Absalom, call now Hushai the Archite also, and let us hear likewise what he said. Now there was no need for this after Ahithophel gave his advice, but something or someone, we'll get to that in just a moment, kind of pricks Absalom and says, hey, why don't you get a second opinion? So he says, let's see what Hushai has to say, verse 6. And when Hushai was come to Absalom, Absalom spake unto him, saying, Ahithophel hath spoken after this manner. Shall we do after his saying? If not, speak thou. And Hushai said unto Absalom, the counsel that Ahithophel hath given is not good at this time. Normally it'd be good, but at this time, I don't think it's so good. Verse 8, for, said Hushai, thou knowest that thy father and his men, that they be mighty men, and they be chafed in their minds as a bear robbed of her whelps in the field. And thy father is a man of war, and will not lodge with the people. Behold, he is hid now in some pit or in some other place. And it will come to pass, when some of them be overthrown at the first, that whosoever heareth it will say, there is a slaughter among the people that follow Absalom. And he also that is valiant, whose heart is as the heart of a lion, shall utterly melt. For all Israel knoweth that thy father is a mighty man, and they which be with him are valiant men. Therefore, I counsel that all Israel be generally gathered unto thee from Dan even to Beersheba. Dan's in the far north, Beersheba in the south. As the sand that is by the sea for multitude, and that thou go to battle in thine own person. So shall we come upon him in some place where he should be found, and we will light upon him as the dew falleth on the ground. And of him and all the men that are with him, there shall not be left so much as one. Moreover, if he be gotten into a city, then shall all Israel bring ropes to that city, and we will draw it into the river until there be not one small stone found there. And Absalom and all the men of Israel said, the counsel of Hushai the Archite is better than the counsel of Ahithophel. For the Lord had appointed to defeat the good counsel of Ahithophel, to the intent that the Lord might bring evil upon Absalom. So what advice it is that Hushai gives? He says, Ahithophel's advice is not going to work at this time. It's not good right now, because basically he says, you're not going to be able to find David. He's going to be hiding. He's not going to be with the people. I don't think Ahithophel and 12,000 men are going to be able to find David. If we're going to find David, we're going to need everybody, because David's hiding, because he is a mighty warrior. All the people that are with him are valiant. And if you go out there with just 12,000 measly men, by the way, I don't even think David has that many men. We're not told a number. But David's men are probably in the hundreds and not the thousands. He says, if you only go out with 12,000 men, they're going to strike down some of them. They're going to begin, they're going to kill some of them. And all of a sudden, it's going to spread through the camps that there's a slaughter. And then David's men, it's going to be a morale boost. And they're going to rise up with courage and they're going to overthrow. They might kill all 12,000 of the men. This is just not going to work. And I don't think Ahithophel is a great warrior. So he says, if we're going to do something successful, because David is such a valiant warrior and his men, and because this is so important, we need to take all of Israel and Absalom, you are going to need to go yourself. Ahithophel, nah, his mind's kind of clouded. I don't think he's going to be able to figure it out. The battle is going to be so hard that Absalom is going to take someone as wonderful as you. And you see what happens here is that Hushai appeals to Absalom's ego. Absalom loves, by the way, to be told how great he is. He loves to be told how wonderful and long and flowing his hair is. He loves to be told how handsome he is, that there's nobody like you in all of Israel. Later on, we find out at the end that he's built a statue for himself. And Absalom loves to be told how wonderful he is. And so Hushai plays into this. He says, this is going to take you because you know your father, how great he is. This is going to be the family of David has to be involved. David is so great, it's going to take his own son to overcome him and all of Israel. And he says, we don't need just some quick battle. We need some long, drawn out civil war. If you put it in different words, it wouldn't be so appealing. We need to kill everybody and divide the whole nation. And if they go into a city, he uses some hyperbole, we're going to take ropes and drag the whole city into the river, which obviously is not going to happen. But he's just really appealing to Absalom here. We're going to have this be the greatest military operation anyone's ever seen. And which, by the way, all of this would take a lot more time. This is the crux of Hushai's advice. If we go with 12,000 men, Ahithophel says, we can go this night. We'll go get them right away. But Hushai says, no, we need to gather all Israel. So how long is it going to take to get the word out? It's going to take a while, but it's going to be worth the wait. And so he's stalling. He's trying to buy time so that David can escape and regroup and get everything together. And so Hushai's advice here, again, it appeals to Absalom's ego, and that's why it takes hold. Notice how quickly everyone shifted. When Ahithophel gave his advice, everyone said, that's good advice. And then when it's done, when Hushai gives advice, everyone switches over and says, that is even better. And what happens here is supernatural. For all these people, and they all know that Ahithophel gives great advice, but for the entire nation, for Absalom and all the men of Israel to switch over in a second, there is something supernatural going on. It's almost like they're under hypnosis. It's like he Jedi mind tricked them and said, I have better advice than Ahithophel. And they all said, he has better advice than Ahithophel. And they just go to it. The tide turns so quickly. And God causes them to agree with Hushai. God blinded their minds to the advice of Ahithophel. And this is similar. This reminds me of what it says in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 and verse 10. This is something that's going to happen during the tribulation period. The Bible says that the man of sin, earlier in this chapter, calls him the man of sin. The Antichrist is going to come. And he is going to deceive many people into thinking that he is God, that he is to be worshipped, and they're going to take the mark of the beast. And it says that everyone that takes the mark of the beast will be judged, will be destroyed by God. But listen to what it says, 2 Thessalonians 2 and verses 10 through 12. It says, and with all deceivableness of unrighteousness in them that perish, because they received not the love of the truth, that they might be saved. So because these people reject the gospel, reject truth, here's what happens. Verse 11, And for this cause, God shall send them strong delusion, that they should believe a lie, that they all might be damned who believed not the truth, but had pleasure in unrighteousness. There's going to come a point, and I believe the point is when people take the mark of the beast, that at that point, which no one's going to accidentally take the mark of the beast, there's nothing that you can do right now that you're taking the mark of the beast. The mark of the beast will be given by the beast, the Antichrist, and it will be a mark. It says it'll be in someone's hand or in their forehead, and without this, you won't be able to buy or sell. But by taking this mark, you will be recognizing the Antichrist as God. It will be an act of worship. It will be an act of rejection of the gospel and rejection of God. And at that point that people take the mark, everyone that takes the mark of the beast, this verse will apply to them. God will send them strong delusion. They will believe a lie, and none of them will repent. None of them will turn. Now, many people during the tribulation will believe the gospel, but not anyone that takes the mark of the beast. God will cause them to believe the lies. And I believe that's what happened here, is that God caused Absalom and all these men to believe the lie of Hushai, that this was better advice. And it says, this is what we find out in verse 14. This is probably the most instructive verse in the whole chapter. The most important verse is verse 14. Where it says that God had appointed to defeat the counsel of Ahithophel, that he might bring evil on Absalom. This is, the whole thing is done before it gets started. They haven't even gone and chased after David yet, but before it's done, it is doomed because God has ordained, God has appointed to defeat the counsel of Ahithophel, so that he will bring evil upon Absalom. In short, God is with and for David. God is against Absalom and all the men and all the counsel and the advice that is with him. Listen to Romans chapter 5 in verse 20. So God is with David and God has been against him. Remember, we talked about that God is bringing evil on him from within his own house. And so Absalom rises up against him. But God had already given David a promise that is going to overcome this judgment that is there. Before David sinned with Bathsheba, 2 Samuel chapter 7, God had given David a promise that we often call the Davidic covenant. And in this promise, God had promised him that his kingdom would continue. Let me read it. 2 Samuel 7 verse 16, it says, "And thine house and thy kingdom shall be established forever before thee. Thy throne shall be established forever." It was impossible for David's throne to be overthrown by Absalom. And some would say, well, I mean, Absalom's the descendant of David. Couldn't Absalom reign and you could still call it eventually the throne of David, his father? But no, God had been specific that it's going to be through Solomon, another son. Listen to 1 Chronicles 22 and verse 7. And this, by the way, is given, this passage we're going to read, it's later than 2 Samuel, but chronologically, David writes this and David says this before Solomon is born, probably. It's when David is trying to build the temple. 1 Chronicles 22 and verse 7. We know it's before Solomon's born because it's before David commits adultery with Solomon's mother, Bathsheba. And Solomon was the fourth son of Bathsheba. So 1 Chronicles 22, 7. "And David said to Solomon, my son, as for me, it was in my mind to build an house unto the name of the Lord my God. But the word of the Lord came to me saying," and God says this before Solomon's born, "but the word of the Lord came to me saying, thou hast shed blood abundantly and hast made great wars. Thou shalt not build an house unto my name, because thou hast shed much blood upon the earth in my sight. Behold, a son shall be born to thee, who shall be a man of rest. And I will give him rest from all his enemies round about, for his name shall be Solomon. And I will give peace and quietness unto Israel in his days." So before Solomon was even born, it was prophesied that he would have a son named Solomon. And by the way, after this prophecy, David had other sons of different names. And so how did they know which one to name Solomon? I think God probably intervened and said, okay, this is the one. You name this one Solomon. This is the one that will be the next king. So God had promised that David's kingdom was going to continue forever through Solomon and so on until Jesus, and Jesus will reign forever and ever. It was therefore impossible for Absalom to win here. It was therefore impossible for even David's sin with Bathsheba to derail God's promise. And it shows us a wonderful truth about God, that God makes a promise. And when God makes a promise, there might be judgment that comes, but it can never overcome a promise. A promise is a promise. And God had promised, if we can put it this way, if we can liken the Davidic covenant to our salvation, and then liken David's sin with Bathsheba and resulting consequences, we can liken that to a believer falling away from God in sin. And God will bring judgment, but the judgment will never overcome our salvation. God has already made us a promise, and he will never take away our salvation. He may take away other things. We may lose rewards in heaven. We may lose crowns. We may even have to be put to death for our sin, the sin unto death that the Bible talks about. But we will never lose our salvation, because God made a promise first that trumps any other judgments that come in our lives. Listen to what it says in Romans 5, verse 20. Moreover, the law entered that the offense might abound. But where sin abounded, grace did much more abound. We may sin in our lives, and that sin might abound, but the grace of God abounds even more than our sin. And God's promise of forgiveness is sure and everlasting. Nothing can ever take that away. Now, it's unclear how much David, in this moment, so David's on the run from Absalom, he's in fear. It's unclear exactly how much David believes in this promise at this point. Is David, as he's running, is he thinking about the Davidic covenant? Is he thinking, hey, wait a minute, God's already promised me that my kingdom's going to continue through Solomon, so there's no way that Absalom can win here. Does David know that? Remember the time that David had been anointed as a boy? So this has happened before in David's life, where God has anointed him and given him the promise, you're going to be the next king. But before he became the next king, Saul was chasing him, trying to kill him. It was therefore impossible that Saul could have killed him, because God had already given him a promise. And David at times doubted that promise. Remember the time when he said, I shall now one day perish by the hand of Saul. So he had doubt come into his mind at times. Is David living in doubt at this moment? We don't know for sure. But David could have taken this promise to the bank. Similar, by the way, to another promise. Remember when God gave Abraham the promise that you're going to have a son and your descendants will be as the sand of the sea through your son Isaac. And then God gives him a test to see if he will stick with him and believe. And he says, I want you to take your son Isaac and sacrifice him. And Abraham does. He climbs the mountain, he ties him up, he lifts the knife, and God stops him. He doesn't have to sacrifice him. But Abraham believed that even if he had to sacrifice him, God's still going to keep his promise. And he's thinking, I guess God would have to bring him back from the dead. Hebrews 11 tells us that's what was in Abraham's mind. Let me read it very quickly. Hebrews 11, 17. By faith, Abraham, when he was tried, offered up Isaac, and he that had received the promises offered up his only begotten son, of whom it was said that in Isaac shall thy seed be called, accounting that God was able to raise him up even from the dead, from whence also he received him in a figure. What amazing faith Abraham had on that day. He believed God's promise more than what he could see right now. And David had multiple promises, and we have multiple promises from God. God says, I will be with you. I will give you everlasting life. No man shall pluck you out of my hand. No matter what you may see today, we've got to go back to the promises of God and know that God's promises overcome anything else that can happen, anything that we can see. We need to have this faith in the promises of God, in the word of God in our lives. We need to know that the decrees and the plan of God will always be triumphant. No matter how many people are involved, no matter how many people try to overturn and overcome the counsel and the will of God. The sovereignty of God reigns supreme in the whole universe. That's the main idea that we see from this chapter. We see it in other places in the Bible. Listen to Psalm 2, verses 1 through 5. Here's what David writes. Why do the heathen rage and the people imagine a vain thing? The kings of the earth set themselves, and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us break their bands in sunder and cast away their cords from us. He that sitteth in the heavens shall laugh. The Lord shall have them in derision. Then shall he speak unto them in his wrath and vex them in his sore displeasure. It says they're imagining a vain thing. What a vain thing to think you can fight against God and overcome him. And God in heaven just looks down at the vanity, at the futility of man, and he just laughs at it. And then, but it's not a laughing matter. It says he will have them in derision. He will speak to them in his wrath. He will vex them in his sore displeasure. So he laughs to himself. But it brings wrath and anger and judgment on anyone that fights against God. And we need to know that all the ideas of man against God will all come to nothing because God is sovereign over the universe. And that brings us to number three, back in 2 Samuel 17. It brings us to Hushai's warning. So Hushai gave some advice, or I'm sorry, Ahithophel gave advice, and then Hushai gave advice. He didn't yet know which advice was going to be taken. Absalom's still mulling it over. So as soon as he gives the advice, he does this. Verse 15. Then said Hushai unto Zadok and to Abiathar the priests, thus and thus did Ahithophel counsel Absalom and the elders of Israel, and thus have I counseled. Now therefore send quickly and tell David, saying, lodge not this night in the plains of the wilderness, but speedily pass over, lest the king be swallowed up and all the people that are with him. Now Jonathan and Ahimaaz stayed by Enrogel, for they might not be seen to come into the city. And a wench went and told them, and they went and told King David. Nevertheless, a lad saw them and told Absalom. But they went both of them away quickly and came to a man's house in Bahurim, which had a well in his court, whither they went down. They went down into this well to hide. And the woman took and spread a covering over the well's mouth and spread ground corn thereon, and the thing was not known. And when Absalom's servants came to the woman to the house, they said, where is Ahimaaz and Jonathan? And the woman said unto them, they be gone over the brook of water. And when they had sought and could not find them, they returned to Jerusalem. And it came to pass, after they were departed, that they came up out of the well and went and told King David and said unto David, arise and pass quickly over the water, for thus hath Ahithophel counseled against you. Then David arose and all the people that were with him, and they passed over Jordan. By the morning light, there lacked not one of them that was not gone over Jordan. So again, Hushai doesn't yet know which direction Absalom's going to decide. And so he sends advice. And there's this, they're playing the game of telephone. Hushai goes to the two priests, and the two priests go to this woman, this lady, and this lady goes to Ahimaaz and Jonathan, and they carry one by one this message. So it says that the two young men, the sons of the priest, they were going to be messengers, but they couldn't come into the city because they'd be recognized. So they're hiding outside the city, and the priest sends word by the woman. The woman sends word by the young men, and the young men go and send word to David. But on the way, they are spotted by this lad. I think Absalom may have a series of spies set up to see either that or this boy just happens to see them. And Absalom sends out people to try to capture these two men. And so they hide at this man's house in a well. And this woman covers over the well and then spreads ground corn, ground wheat over the well, So it's probably level with the ground and just looks like ground. You can't tell that there's anything under it. She hides the two messengers, and then she lies to the men that come. Oh, yeah, they took off. You better hurry, find them. They just crossed over the brook right there, the brook Kidron. And so the two men, they look and they can't find them. They return to Jerusalem. Then the wench brings them out of the well and they go on and tell David. And what a thrilling story of close calls and courage. You know, it's like reads like one of these espionage spy novels. This is very similar, you may notice, to the story of Rahab when the two spies came to Jericho and Rahab, it says that she believes in the true God and she receives the spies. She hides them and sends out the soldiers another way. She hides them. She lies. She delivers them, just like this story, very similar. If this message, by the way, this is a crucial message. If the messengers are intercepted, then it could mean disaster for everyone. And so God allowed it to be successful, even though the woman tells a lie. We're not going to get into this a whole lot right now. But we need to know that God wants truth no matter what. Sometimes people say, well, it's okay to lie as long as you're lying to the enemies of God. As long as you're lying for a good reason, a good purpose, then the end can justify the means. And we're not going to go down that rabbit trail. We're not going to go down that direction in our Christian lives. God wants truth. Nevertheless, God allowed this to be successful. And we need to know this, by the way. Lying is never your only option. Sometimes it feels like, oh, the only thing I could do was to lie. And remember, it's similar to the story of Rahab. I want to read what the New Testament says very quickly about Rahab, even though she lied. The New Testament doesn't mention her lie, but it mentions her faith. It mentions why she did what she did. Hebrews 11:31, it says, by faith, the harlot Rahab perished not with them that believed not, when she had received the spies with peace. So the reason that she received the spies and hid them and protected them was that she believed in the true God. She was on their side. And by faith, she didn't perish. God saved her life because she believed. And I believe that this woman does what she does by faith. Rather than turn with most of the men of Israel against David, against God's anointed king, and side with Absalom, she stays with David. And so she endangers her own life. She helps preserve the lives of these two men. And she does what she does by faith. So that's Ahithophel's warning to David. And David and his men flee. And it brings us to number four, Ahithophel's death. So the two counselors have given their advice. One is followed, one is not. Hushai gives warning in case his advice is not followed. And Ahithophel then sees that his advice is not followed. And we see his end in verse 23. 2 Samuel 17:23, it says, and when Ahithophel saw that his counsel was not followed, he saddled his ass and arose and got him home to his house, to his city, and put his household in order, and hanged himself and died and was buried in the sepulcher of his father. Some people, if their advice is not taken, just fly apart and lose it. Now, by the way, that's not exactly what's happening here, but that is true. With some people, it's either their way or the highway. You have to follow my advice, and some people are control freaks. I don't think that's exactly what's happening with Ahithophel. But he, it seems, saw that because his advice was not followed, he knew that Hushai's advice, and by the way, I don't know if he knew that Hushai is doing what he does on purpose. He doesn't out him as a mole. He doesn't out him as a spy. He doesn't say, hey, he's trying to pull the wool over your eyes. If you follow that, it's going to fail. But he knows that this advice will fail. He knows that it's going to be unsuccessful. The only way we're going to get David is if we do it quickly, if we do it overnight. And so he knows that not only is Absalom now going to fail, but David is going to come back and he is going to be held to account for his treason. He knows that what he has done is treason. He knows that he deserves to die. He knows that he will be put to death by David when he comes back. And so he just does it himself, if I can put it that way. He ends his life so that he won't have to face David, so he won't have to face the consequences of his choices. Judas is another person in the Bible, famously, that killed himself, that hanged himself, and committed suicide. Let's read very quickly the account of where he does it, and we'll just draw a couple of parallels between the two men. Matthew 27:3, it says, "Then Judas, which had betrayed him," so obviously we know that Judas betrays Jesus for 30 pieces of silver, and after that, he feels guilty, says, "Ah, I've betrayed the innocent blood." "Then Judas, which had betrayed him, when he saw that he was condemned, repented himself, and brought again the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and elders, saying, 'I have sinned in that I have betrayed the innocent blood.' And they said, 'What is that to us? See thou to that.' And he cast down the pieces of silver in the temple and departed and went and hanged himself." The similarity between the two men, Judas and Ahithophel, is that both of them have conspired to treason, if we can put it this way. They both aspired to betray the king of Israel, and with Judas, the king of the universe, who is also the king of Israel, in Jesus Christ himself. However, Ahithophel was wronged by the king, so he's doing what he does in vengeance. Judas, because Jesus didn't do everything exactly the way he wanted. I think Judas's motivation was, when he saw that Jesus was not going to set up a kingdom and overthrow the Romans, he said, "I don't want a spiritual kingdom. I'm out. I only want a kingdom that's going to deliver us from Rome." And so he does what he does. Judas is overcome by guilt when he does what he does. Ahithophel, he's overcome by the impending doom of his decisions and also by cowardness. So it's not God's will for anyone ever to kill themselves. Suicide is never God's plan for people. But often people in the Bible and others will do it because of sin that they have committed. With both of them, with Ahithophel and Judas, and you can trace it with anyone in the Bible that kills themselves, it's always because of sin they've committed. And then they don't deal with that sin properly. What's the right way to deal with sin? Confession. "Whoso confesseth and forsaketh shall have mercy." But whenever we do the wrong thing with sin, whenever we try to cover it up, whenever we just kind of deal with it on our own, it can lead sometimes to suicide. Suicide is always the result of being of sin being dealt with in the wrong way. And, you know, we need to know that we can never do anything. This is what Ahithophel is trying to avoid. He's going to kill himself to try to have a quick death and avoid the consequences of his sin. But we need to know that we can never avoid the consequences of sin. Even if we kill ourselves, all we do is hasten that judgment. We go and we stand before God, and no one, and then everything is found out. We will answer to God for everything we say and think and do in life. Nobody ever gets away with anything. So Ahithophel here, he had begun to fight against God, and it came to ruin. And that is a snapshot here, a little bit of a microcosm in Ahithophel's end, of all attempts to overthrow the authority of God. It will always come to nothing. It might be successful temporarily. You might be able to get a mutiny. You might be able to get a coup. You might be able to have a rebellion, a revolution for a time. But eventually, those decisions will come to nothing. They will be brought to judgment, because God is ultimately victorious. I want to finish with just a couple of passages, a couple of verses that bear this out. Daniel chapter 4 and verse 35, Nebuchadnezzar recognizes this about God. He says, "And all the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing." Compared to God, we are all, the entire world together is nothing. Have you ever seen a picture, you know, pictures and comparisons of the world to celestial bodies, you know, stars and so forth? Our earth is so tiny compared to our sun, and our sun is so tiny compared to some of these other stars out there. And God rules over all of it. When you see the earth from a distance, you look at the earth from the moon, it looks so small and insignificant. And that's what it is to God. God could blot out the entire earth in a second. He could just squish it with his finger. Much less a human being. All humanity on the earth is nothing to God. He is so overwhelmingly powerful. So let's finish out the verse. And all the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing, and he doeth according to his will in the army of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. And none can stay his hand or say unto him, what doest thou? Whenever God decides he is going to do something, he does it, and that's that. And nobody can stop him. Nobody can derail the decrees and the plan and the will of God. His sovereignty is over all. In Luke 20, verse 17 and 18, Jesus is speaking. It says, he beheld them and he said, what is this then that is written? The stone which the builders rejected, the same has become the head of the corner. Ironic that they rejected Jesus. They said, oh, we don't need him. Turns out he's the most important stone in the whole building. Without Jesus, there is no building. And then he goes on in verse 18. Whosoever shall fall upon that stone shall be broken, but on whomsoever it shall fall, it will grind him to powder. And that's what Absalom's doing in his mutiny against David. He is trying to overthrow God himself, the kingdom of God, the ordained king, the ordained man of God. He's trying to fight against God, and you can't fight against God and win. And then whoever God falls on, it will grind, he will grind him to powder, into dust. Get on board God's train, because it's bound for glory. Follow Jesus and the authority that he has set up over you. To resist is futile, and all attempts to overthrow it will fail.